The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host for Desiree Shell. Today I'm here with Tom Levinson, professor and head of the Writing and Humanistic Studies program at MIT, and author of Newton and the Counterfeiter, The Unknown Detective Career of the World's Greatest Scientist. Hi, and welcome, Tom. It's a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show.
I think we should just jump right into the story, and I think we should just start from the beginning. If you can tell us how Sir Isaac Newton, Lucasian professor of mathematics, who we know from the law of gravity, how did he end up being a detective?
Well, it's partly the problem of what happens when you become famous and bored, I guess. Newton published his great book, the Principia Mathematica, the foundational text of the scientific revolution, in 1687. And up to that point, he'd been known to a limited circle of learned men as, a really sharp guy. But he wasn't the sort of world historical genius he became sort of immediately on publication. I mean, he really stepped into the 17th century version of scientific celebrity overnight. I mean, he became a hugely famous person in that milieu. And he lived in Cambridge, which was a tiny town, 5,000 people, for at that point, well over a quarter of a century. And he seemed to have a completely grounded life there. But after that, for reasons having to do with sort of other currents in English history, he spent a year in London as a member of the convention parliament that legitimized William of Holland's takeover of the English monarchy. And it was a case of sort of how do you keep them down on the farm once they've seen Paris, or in this case, London. Newton came into contact with a much broader community, a much more intellectually powerful community, and a much more exciting sort of social life, in essence, in London in 1688 and 89, went back to Cambridge when the parliament was over, and almost immediately started looking for any kind of gig that could get him back to the big city. And the first one that came along that was really attractive to him was the offer of the post of Warden of the Royal Mint, which when he was offered it was supposed to be almost a no-show job, a sinecure, but turned out, for reasons that we can go into, to be an incredibly demanding job. And one of the most immediate demands was to start chasing after currency criminals, counterfeiters and coiners and clippers.
So he was ended up being a lot busier than he thought he might be.
Absolutely. I mean, he literally had, there's a surviving letter from the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, Montagu, later Earl of Halifax, to Newton saying, you won't have to show up any more than you want to. I mean, that's a slight paraphrase, but come on up, enjoy enjoy your time in the city, dude. That kind of thing. But the Mint was at that point, it had always been, it was really very much a feudal institution, and people had accepted the jobs, and you made a lot of money being an officer of the Mint. There are all kinds of ways, many of them legal, some of them quite corrupt, by which senior members of the Mint could do very well for themselves indeed. And it was in general that kind of patronage plum job. But in 1695, when Newton took over the post, there were a couple things happening. 1696, excuse me. There were a couple of things happening. First of all, England was in the middle of a war it couldn't afford to pay for. They were fighting. William, when he took power in 1688, had almost immediately launched a war with Louis XIV of France. And there was a sort of ongoing continental drain on England's finances. And so there was big high finance need for as much government revenue as possible, and so forth and so on. And that was confounded by the fact that the English currency itself, the actual stuff with which you paid your bills, the metal coins, because that was what was legal tender, was in terrible shape. It was in great disrepair for a couple of reasons. One is that there were two systems of coins, silver coins, one of which was set to full weight and couldn't be easily, there were all kinds of safeguards that meant it couldn't be clipped or, debased in certain ways. But the problem was there was too much silver in each coin, so much so that the value of the silver just as metal was more than it was worth in the face value of the coin. So, of course, when you have a situation like that, everybody grabs the coin, they hoard them, they melt them down, and they ship them to places where they can sell them as metal. In this case, you know, on the continent of Europe. And they'd buy gold, come back, trade gold for more silver, and there's this sort of perpetual motion machine, with the result that England's legal silver currency was just disappearing. At the same time, there was an older set of a pre-1662 coinage that was also still traded as legal currency that was much easier to debase. You could clip the edges of it, you could dissolve some of the coin with acids and so forth, and harvest little bits of silver. And it sounds sort of odd. I mean, how can you make any money clipping, you know, a couple of grams or less off the edge of each shilling piece you come across? But it was so rampant that by the time Newton took office, that the remaining coins in circulation, and there were only these old coins because these newer coins, these heavy coins, had all been hoarded or sold. These older coins were down to 50% of their legal weight. It was as if half the entire money supply of Britain had been just sort of stolen. I mean, this sounds very kind of esoteric and kind of wonky and all that, but the fundamental result was the daily business life of England and the tax receipts that the government was obligated to accept in this terrible debased coinage and that could help pay for this expensive war. Both of these things were just in terrible shape. People couldn't buy their pound of beef and their tankard of ale for their dinner because they didn't have any small coins because they were all debased or gone. And the English government revenues were in terrible suspect shape, so much so that the ability of the British government to continue to wage war on the continent was legitimately in doubt. They might have lost the war through just coinage, you know, through currency failure. And that was unacceptable. So as soon as Newton got to the Mint, he was embroiled in this enormous effort at once to save the currency and to defeat what was becoming a plague of counterfeiting. Because, of course, if there aren't legitimate coins in circulation, then, you know, human nature and markets being what they are, people will come along and try and supply the coins the government can't. And if they don't quite have the right amount of silver or what have you, well, you know.
Yeah, someone's going to come in and fill that need, whatever way they can, aren't they?
Absolutely. And just to give you a sense of the scale, remember, half the legal coinage is missing because it's just been stolen through clipping and acid washing and so forth. And of what was in circulation when Newton took over, more than one coin in 10 was a fake.
The numbers really startled me, how much of the money was affected and how much of it was really gone. So his nemesis, I guess, in the story is Chaloner. Can you tell me a little bit about him?
William Chaloner is, among many other things, every writer's dream, a really delicious scoundrel. I mean, he was a delightfully bad guy. There's very little original source material on him. There's a sort of penny dreadful biography that was printed right after his death. There are a couple things that he wrote. There are some recollections. And then there's Newton's own investigative dossiers. He actually sicked his agents on him and got a fair amount of the information that survives about him come directly from Newton's investigation. So, you know, with all that, some of this is sketchy, but basically, apparently, he was too much for his parents to handle, so they apprenticed him off to a nail maker, which I think was quite important because it meant that he got the rudiments of working with metal from a very early age. He then did something that was actually quite a serious move in those days. He ran from his apprenticeship. He was in Birmingham, which was then also quite a small town, maybe 10,000 people, maybe a little bit more, and probably walked to London. He was almost certainly too poor to have hired a horse, and unlikely to have had the money to get a ride on any of the carts or conveyances. So he walked from Birmingham to London, most likely. And almost immediately, as a teenager, most likely, started a criminal career that was really, you know, varied and exciting and you know, in its own way, a lens into the, you know, just incredibly rowdy, dangerous, tumultuous life of what was then the very, very big city. I mean, London was close to 700,000 people, and it was, you know, bigger than the next 60 cities and towns in England all put together. So even though Chaloner came from a fairly substantial country town in Birmingham, when he got to London, he was in a completely different environment. And it's a measure of his cleverness that he actually got his feet under him and started being quite a successful bad guy very early on.
Wow, and building himself up really from nothing when he arrived.
Yep, I love it. His biographer says he started by hawking tin watches with dildos in them.
Yeah, that was a pretty funny part of the book.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I had fun with it. It took me a long time to figure out what those must have been. I had to call a lot of people in the history of clock business, the so-called horologists.
Oh, okay.
And eventually what we concluded is most like there were these things called pewter watches, which were not in fact watches. In those days, you know, the balance spring, the balance spring mechanism for keeping reliable time in a small timepiece was only about, you know, maybe 15, 20 years old. Robert Hooke had invented it in the 1660s. And watches that use this mechanism were like the Apple iPhone 4S or the Galaxy, you know, phone or whatever it is. The high style bleeding edge of high technology in 17th century London. And just as now, people who couldn't afford that kind of technology still wanted the emblems of it. So there were these things called tin watches that looked like watches. They were made of pewter. They had a shape, they had a case, they might even have a design on them, but there was no clockwork inside. They were just for show. They were costume jewelry in essence. Uh-huh. And there's a suspicion that I and my informants on this developed was that these watches had some kind of pornographic design on them.
Right.
You know, there is another possible interpretation. Dildos at that point also meant decoration, but the other context of the quote suggests that something lewder was in the biographer's mind. So he did this, and what the biographer said is he was hawking these things on street corners, you know, like, you know, the sort of dirty old man with an overcoat full of novelties. But the purpose wasn't so much as to make money as to get entree into criminal London, because, you know, it wasn't easy being just a kid with no friends from the provinces and to break into crime. It was in many ways just as organized and just as restricted as the regular guilds and societies would have been for people who wanted to make a straight living.
Right, and you had to find your way in somewhere.
That's right, and Chaloner chose it through this kind of junior pornographer's path, perhaps.
Well, it did get his foot in the door, I think.
Yeah.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. Today I'm here talking to science writer Tom Levinson about his book, Newton and the Counterfeiter, The Unknown Detective Career of the World's Greatest Scientist. So you've introduced us to the main characters, Isaac Newton, William Chaloner, but how much of the story, and you've alluded to this a little bit already, but how much of it is really about the history of our modern ideas about money?
In some ways, the entire story is about that. Yeah. I don't think people are, I certainly wasn't aware of this until I started working on this project, the degree to which the financial revolution and the scientific revolution were deeply intertwined, and the way in which, you know, the people who were the architects of the scientific revolution were also significant players in transformations in the world of money and finance. When Newton was a boy, and even into adulthood, money, as most people experienced it, meant a material thing, a chunk of silver in England, which was the foundational currency, or gold, with a picture of a king stamped on the front, and some number saying it's worth, you know, 5 shillings or 10 shillings or whatever it might be. And that was money. And you could have representations of cash in some forms of paper. You could have a promise or a draft from one banker to another in different cities and so forth. But the fundamental notion is that money always meant some physical amount of gold or silver.
Right.
And by the end of Newton's life, and in part, you know, aided by Newton's actions and that of people like Edmund Halley of the Comet and others, money came to include a much broader set of possible instruments. And you began, not entirely, I mean, Newton, for example, was instrumental in moving England to the gold standard, where gold coins formed what was thought to be the real currency. But this was the period at which, first of all, you first begin to see paper currency, actual legitimate paper notes. The first Bank of England paper notes as legal tender were issued in 1694, just before Newton got to the mint. But you also start seeing ways to represent money not as a fixed physical object that in itself doesn't change, but as an idea on which you can perform calculations. You can think about its value in the future. If you make a promise of money, you know, 10 years from now, what's that worth in current, today's value, and so forth and so on. You start having bonds. You start having very interesting hybrids of, you know, debt instruments that offer the possibility of buying stocks. So you have, you know, convertible debt for equity stuff. You have lottery tickets that are at once gambling instruments, legal currency just for their face value, and long-term bonds that will pay you a certain amount of money over time. You have all these different experiments, but all of them collapse into this idea that's common between the financial revolution and the scientific revolution, in that you move from thinking about, you know, a direct material observation. I'm watching the flight of that cannonball. I am tracing the path of this shilling from me to my baker, from the baker to the, you know, the flower seller, and so forth and so on. And you're abstracting that into ideas upon which you can perform, into concepts and quantities into which you can perform mathematical calculations. Newton was intimately involved in that. He understood the importance of credit. He recognized, in essence, as did others at the time, that the issuing of credit was in effect issuing money. That when the British government sold bonds to the public and promised to pay interest on those bonds into the future, they actually increased the amount of money in circulation through this issuance. And these were revolutionary ideas, and they had a revolutionary impact. And all of that's happening actually directly in the process by which, you know, the counterfeiter counterfeits. He starts counterfeiting gold coins, and he finishes counterfeiting these malt lottery tickets, which are these combination, you know, gambling instruments, legal tender, and bonds that I was talking about. And Newton's chasing him every step of the way, and at the same time trying to figure out how to make coins properly, warning that the recoinage isn't going to work, and defending the idea of government credit to people who still thought that the only thing worth actually trading in was a solid silver shilling.
And you actually mentioned a couple times that Chaloner himself is a little bit a revolutionary in a sense as well. Is that kind of a fair assessment?
I probably said that. It's probably slightly hyperbolic. I think what I'd be willing to really defend is that Chaloner, more than almost everyone else, very few, I think, other Englishmen at the time, really grasped how radically transformative the new ideas about money were about. And he was very adept with dealing with metal and with coins and with the tools and techniques of both coining and hence counterfeiting. But he was among the first, for example, to pass bad checks. You know, he recognized as fast, and probably faster than any other criminal in London, the opportunities inherent in trading in paper. And I think, there is a sense that he really was going, when he was finally trapped and caught, he was at his wit's end. He'd been hounded by Newton for 2 years, and he'd run out of resources and he'd run out of friends. But he was still trying to make the big score, and he actually, you know, wasn't actually that far off doing it. And he was doing it with paper, not with coins.
So he was at least, if not revolutionary, at least kind of creative and flexible.
Absolutely. He didn't advance the revolution in paper, but when it was happening around him, when this abstraction of money from things to ideas was occurring, he recognized it very quickly, and he tried to take advantage of it as soon as it was available to him.
How did you find Chaloner and this story of him and Newton?
Long ago, I mean, in the 90s, that's fairly long ago, I was working on a book on a completely different project. It was a history of science told through scientific and musical instruments. And of course, if you start with the Greeks and go to the present day, you sort of run through Newton somewhere along the way.
Of course.
And so I was reading a couple of Newton biographies, and in a fair one that's now quite obscure, that nobody really reads anymore, I found a quote from a letter Chaloner wrote to Newton after he'd been caught, when he was days away from being executed. And it's this just piteous, heart-rending letter. You know, oh, dear sir, have mercy on me. I will be murdered if you don't take action. Pity me. Please, you know, help me, help me, help me. Oh, your near murdered humble servant, W. Chaloner. And, you know, I was doing that project, and I had a couple other projects lined up behind it and so forth. But I was struck by both this, you know, really, you know, sudden, absolutely human voice calling to me across, you know, three centuries saying, you know, I am in the shadow of the gallows and the grave. I'm terrified. Help me. I mean, that was moving. Yeah. But of course, being a writer, I was sort of go, okay, be moved now. What an amazing story there must be behind whatever it was that brought this criminal into correspondence with the person I only knew as the greatest scientific mind of his age. Yeah. How could this happen? What did this tell you about what was going on in society? What was the story behind, you know, what combination of events and historical circumstances could lie behind that letter to make that letter possible? So that stuck with me. And, you know, years and years later, I finally got back to it and came up with this book.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we'll be right back with Tom Levinson and his book, Newton and the Counterfeiter, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. I'm talking today to Tom Levinson about his book, Newton and the Counterfeiter, The Unknown Detective Career of the World's Greatest Scientist. Tom is a professor of science journalism at MIT and also winner of the Walter P. Kistler Science Documentary Film Award for his work on the Nova series Origins. And I think actually we'll take our first emailed-in question, and this is from Linda.
What do you think of the arguments that going back to the gold standard would be a good move for the modern global economy?
I think the same people who advocate the gold standard in the modern economy would like to actually start teaching flat earth geography and think that probably bloodletting is superior to antibiotics as a treatment for infection. It's a bat excrement crazy idea. You have to ask yourself what money is. Now, if you are, and you also, I mean, there are two things. First of all, every country that's ever been on a gold standard or a metallic standard or some kind of restricted material object as the instrument of exchange has hoped thereby to ensure some kind of stability of prices, some kind of security against counter, all this sort of stuff. The problem is, you know, these currencies are not immune to currency manipulation. The idea is if you only have gold, you'll never have people, you know, printing money and causing inflation or what have you. Edward the First, I believe it was, one of the first three Edwards, but I'm almost certain it was Edward the First of England, famously debased his gold currency because his wars in Scotland and Wales cost more than his revenue could support. So he basically just, you know, stole the money. Which you can do with a gold, you know, right. Just because you have a gold coin doesn't mean the gold coin is what it says it is. And it's not just counterfeiters, it's kings who commit those crimes. So just the fact that you've got gold doesn't mean you're going to get an honest currency. But even accepting that as a principle, you have to ask yourself what money is and what it's supposed to do. And money, you know, what's really interesting is in some ways, I don't need to answer this question. I can just send you to the Papers of Benjamin Franklin. It's online. I think it's at Yale University. Anyway, just do okay. Benjamin Franklin Papers. And there is a pamphlet he wrote in 1729 on issuing paper money in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And he explains what money is supposed to do. And money is supposed to be adequate to the economic activity of the territory in which the money is circulating.
Right.
If you have an insufficient supply of gold, prices rise, proprietors get rich, renters lose, the cost of labor gets, the return to labor gets diminished. And Franklin lays all this out, and he's incredibly scathing about the moneyed and landed elite who are trying to artificially pump up the value of their coin at the expense of daily trade and the work of Philadelphia and Pennsylvania. And it's really true. You know, if you ask yourself what money represents, it represents the present value of the sum integrated future of the economy.
Right.
And if you want to just say it's only, you know, our economy is only going to be so big as a 100 pounds of gold or 100 tons of gold or what have you, then fine. But if you actually think we're going to invent new things and make new things and grow and the population is going to grow and all these things that are you know, actually the way the world works, then a metallic currency is about as stupid and self-defeating an idea as you can imagine.
Giving up really on all the advances that, Newton and those around him and after him brought to
Absolutely.
Modern currency.
Just to toss in another book reference, Fernand Braudel, the great French historian, wrote this astonishing three-volume book called Civilization and Capitalism. Hmm. And there's just a stray note, you know, it's like a two-page essay in the middle of the second volume, The Wheels of Commerce, in which he talks about how England's ability to create a permanent national debt, that is, bonds that the government sold, redeemed, resold, and so forth and so on, created the first capital market that was stable enough to fund first the empire, and then creating a market mechanism that allowed businesses that needed capital now against economic activity in the future. You know, you want to start a company, you borrow some money, you do stuff. If it works out, you make money and you pay off the loan, right? That's how it works. Yeah. And England's advantage in that is much more than France or any of the other continental powers. Britain had worked out a way to partially divorce itself from the restrictions of metallic currency and create a living, breathing financial capital market. And if you want to throw that away, we can go back to, you know, a really restrictive economic system, but nobody will like it. Trust me on this one.
That makes a lot of sense. You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking today to Tom Levinson about his book, Newton and the Counterfeiter. So I want to get back to talking about Newton for a second and who he was. You mentioned that in your mind, he was the greatest scientist that ever lived. And that's the version that we usually talk about of Isaac Newton. He's the one we talk about in high school physics classes. And it usually kind of runs along the lines of one of the most brilliant scientists of all time, before the age of 30, formulated the laws of mechanics, discovered universal law of gravitation, invented the methods of calculus. Basically, brilliant man, did brilliant stuff, the end. And that's all we ever hear. How is the Newton in your book different from that Newton?
He's different in a lot of ways. I mean, first of all, Newton, I still think Newton was the greatest scientist who ever lived, mm-hmm. A brilliant man who transformed not just bodies of knowledge, but ways of thinking mm-hmm. that are completely interwoven in the way the world thinks, the way we think and understand how the world works now. So, I mean, he's one of these people who actually does deserve his reputation. But he wasn't, first of all, he wasn't simply a boy genius. You know, he didn't actually do all that stuff you just said before he was 30. He got started on all that stuff before he was 30. He was, you know.
I got that out of a university physics textbook.
You know, I hate to tell you this.
Sometimes they're wrong.
They lie. No. This is going to get me into all kinds of trouble, but physicists are not always the best sources for the history of physics.
Shocking.
Yeah. There's stuff, you know, it's the old Mark Twain thing. It's not what they don't know, it's what they do know that ain't so that's the problem. And in part, it's things like that have been repeated over and over again. That, yes. You know, Newton had this miracle year when he was, you know, back home escaping from the plague and he figured it all out just getting hit on the head by one apple.
Right.
You know, he certainly got, during those plague years, the miracle years, he got started on working out the calculus. He certainly first came to grips with the problem of gravity. He started thinking about problems of motion. But, you know, at that point, he still had to work out what inertia actually was. He was still trying to tease out the fact that gravity might actually be something that wasn't, you know, an active force inside a body, but was some relationship. I mean, one thing we forget is that Newton had to make himself a Newtonian and probably never quite completed the job in the sense that his younger contemporaries and his heirs were more thoroughly Newtonian than the old man himself ever was. But it took a while, and you know he went back and forth between doing physics and other things, physics and mathematics. And that's one of the differences I learned. I mean, I think people probably have a sense that Newton was a very religious man, and there were more volumes about religion, and he wrote more about religion in various ways than he ever did about natural philosophy or mathematics. He owned more books in his library about it. He was an avid alchemist, and you know, for years, for centuries, The alchemy was seen as sort of the crazy Uncle Newton upstairs, and you didn't let him sit with the other Newtons, Newton the philosopher, Newton the man of science, and so forth. I think there's been scholarship over the last two decades that really have shown that the alchemy was not an aberration. It was an integral part of the development of his thought. It helped him understand what he was trying to do in a wide range of things, and it was consistent with the theme of all his work. He was trying to figure out how God manifested God's presence throughout the world. And part of it was through the motion of the celestial objects, and part of it was through understanding the mathematical order of the universe, and part of it was understanding the processes of growth and generation and change, which is what alchemy was all about. So there's no, to Newton, there was no discontinuity, there was no aberration. It's only looking back on it when we see that alchemy contains within it concepts that seem pretty bizarre, that we say, oh, no, Newton couldn't have done that, he was too smart for that. Well, you know, Newton was fully smart enough to do what Newton did for reasons that made sense to him and make sense when you understand them in context. And most of all, I guess that's a long way around of saying the biggest difference I found in the Newton I knew after writing the book compared with the Newton I knew going into it is that Newton really was a single human being. He wasn't divided up into these different, you know, the Newton the mathematician, Newton the philosopher, Newton the government bureaucrat. That all of these were part and parcel of a life that was a whole life lived by a person who experienced himself as a person, not as this sort of, you know, chorus of different people that history has sometimes made of him.
So we shouldn't sort of let it take away from his accomplishments when we hear about Newton the alchemist or Newton the other things that he does.
The more you understand about Newton's alchemy, it doesn't take away from his accomplishments. It helps make sense of them. And there are things in his alchemy that are just, you know, he was sort of the first and last rigorously quantitative experimental alchemist. He did a lot of chemistry, or as it was then, chemistry, C-H-Y-M, as it was written at the time. He was really working on development of experimental methods. He came closer to modern ideas of error, how you account for error in experiments, than any of his contemporaries did. I don't think you would look at the way he accounted for variation in the outcome of different trials of an experiment as a rigorous construction of error bars in the way we do it now. But compared to what was going on around him, it was quite remarkable. And most of all, his alchemical theory, written in obscure, fanciful-sounding language, as, you know, strange and in some senses troubling that this pinnacle of reason could talk about the green dragon and the breath of the serpent and all these things. One of the things he did is he broke away from the constriction of a strictly mechanical view of the universe. I mean, remember his theory of gravity says, you know, the sun and the earth interact with each other across empty space.
Right.
We're not touching. There are no gears. This contradicted pure mechanical philosophy, the kind of thing that Descartes was proposing with his vortices. And there's a lot of evidence now that that thought became possible to Newton, at least in part, through his long periods of thinking about mechanisms of alchemical transformation. So, you know, there's some alchemy in the physics too. It's hidden. And you never see it in a modern book about you know, mechanics. But, you know, remember, Newton wasn't a real Newtonian. He came from a world in which traditional scientific views or pre-modern or just emerging modern scientific views dominated. He had to work out concepts like inertia and force. There wasn't just the entire mental apparatus of his physics in Principia was something he had to build from scratch. That's why people think he's the greatest scientist ever. You know, Einstein was transformative. I did a biography about Einstein some years ago, and when I finished that, I said, how can people rank Einstein below Newton? Look at all the stuff he did. Look at the comprehensiveness. And it's true. Einstein is remarkable. He is 1A to Newton's 1. But the fact that Newton had to build from scratch the conceptual tools with which to begin to even frame the problems he was trying to solve, that's what puts him off the scale. And, you know, we don't need the alchemy to accept the idea that, you can have forces operating across space. We have other ideas now. We have fields and so forth and so on. But we don't need what Newton needed to get there. But remember, and even Newton's reasonably, you know, immediate successors didn't need that apparatus either. But he did, because he was starting from a different place than everybody after him, everybody after the publication of Principia started from. So, you know, I say my admiration, my sense of Newton got much more complex as I worked through the book, but my admiration for him as a thinker and as a you know, unraveler of secrets just grew. I mean, he really is as remarkable as they say he is, just in somewhat different ways than your physics textbook said.
I found I really thought about Principia a lot differently after reading this. Again, it's kind of like the story in the textbooks, sometimes wrong, but also is just, he said, here are the three laws, here's the law of gravitation, kind of the same thing, you know, here are a couple of brilliant statements. But you give us so much more of the story behind that book as well.
I don't know if this is too nerdy for your readers, but one of the things that Newton did that people don't realize is he started to set the form of modern scientific communication. He wrote his stuff in ways that hadn't been written before. You look at the Principia, it starts with three axioms. You have the three laws of motion. And from that are derived all kinds of things, and there are definitions and so forth. People didn't write that way beforehand. His paper on, one of his early papers on optics is really, in some senses, the first modern scientific paper. You know, it presents an experiment, it presents the results, it presents, you know, a discussion of it. Scientific communication happened by letter, it happened by description and so forth. And Newton really started to formalize, systematize the way you communicated your ideas and suggested just from the way he wrote that there was a different way of thinking about the world. You come up with law-like hypotheses, you test them in certain ways, and you come to conclusions that allow you to interpret the initial axioms in some generalized statement about the behavior of a large class of things out there in the world. That's modern science. And Newton, and you don't just need the discoveries. You need the habits of mind. You need the experimental apparatus. You need the mathematics. You need a sense that you want to organize things against through these patterns. But you also need just the language with which to communicate it. And that's, again, one of the things that makes Newton so incredible is he did all of that.
That's fascinating. I really didn't know that, actually. Great man and greatest scientist in so many ways. We'll be right back to talk more with author Tom Levinson about Sir Isaac Newton, the Royal Mint, and sneaky counterfeiters here on Skeptically Speaking.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at some of the ways motherhood changes the brain and the body. Kate Sukel, author of Dirty Minds, returns to explain the neurological effects of pregnancy and motherhood. And we're joined by Dr. Katie Hind, director of Harvard's Comparative Lactation Laboratory, to discuss the biology of lactation and breastfeeding. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, guest host this week for Desiree Schell. And I'm talking to science writer Tom Levinson about his book, Newton and the Counterfeiter, the unknown detective career of the world's greatest scientist. Tom is professor and head of the program in writing and humanistic studies at MIT. He's also the author of Einstein in Berlin and Measure for Measure, a musical history of science, and also a winner of the National Academy's Science Communication Award and a Peabody Award for his work on ANOVA program origins. You mentioned a little bit about where the information came from and the fact that Chaloner was a little harder to find. You mentioned getting some of your information from Newton's own records, but where else did you find out about this underworld character?
The great good luck I had and the thing that made the entire book possible was tracking down Newton's own records of criminal investigations. Now, we know that Newton burned a lot of those of those records because his nephew-in-law and successor as master of the Mint wrote in a surviving letter or note that he actually one day helped Newton carry out boxes of papers and burn them. But one sort of fairly large folio of these notes survives in the National Archives in Britain. And they were hard to find. They were referenced in one of these old books that I'd started out with, but they aren't readily represented in any of the sort of usual finding aids and so forth. And I actually had to spend about a year, and the records have gone from place to place as the Mint archives have gone from here and there. They've traveled a bit in the 20th century. So it took me about a year to track them down. But when I did, I got myself basically a big folder with roughly 400 handwritten documents on it, numbered. There's about 80 in the middle. It's numbered 1 to sort of 500 something in there, 80 or 90 that are missing even in that. And that's all that's left. But what they are is fascinating because they are essentially summaries of Newton's interrogations and some correspondence that would be written down by a clerk and then signed in if it was an interrogation, signed by the suspect or the informant being questioned and by Newton. And there are a bunch of it's not Newton's handwriting. There are plenty of Newton documents you can check that. So you know it's clerks. The handwriting changes. It's different clerks at different times. And to my great good fortune, the surviving chunk of documents exactly covers the period when Newton was chasing Chaloner.
That's very convenient.
It was. And it also gave you, because there's lots of other investigations and so forth that are going on, and little notes, notes of transfer of prison from one jail to another, this kind of thing, and correspondence between different people that Newton would sometimes have copied out. All that's in the file. And you get a sense of the texture of crime and Newton's pursuit of crime by reading the sort of the whole corpus of these documents, including ones that don't relate to Chaloner. In addition, in the secured portion of the National Archives, there are five big folders of Newton's personal Newton's own holograph documents from the Mint, which include things like drafts, three and four and five drafts of his descriptions of Chaloner or responses to Chaloner's, complaints in Parliament, or his accounts, in his own hand, of the money he spent paying agents, buying, special suits of clothes, transportation charges for all the investigative work he was doing as warden of the Mint. You can see he spent, £5 on a very expensive suit of clothes for somebody to go undercover with a gang of counterfeiters and so on. And it was those documents that made it possible not just to sort of get some sense of Chaloner, because there's some documents by Chaloner himself, some letters and petitions in there, but also to get a feel for what Newton was doing, how Newton turned himself into such an effective cop. I mean, that was the biggest mystery of all, in some sense. Here's Newton. He spends his early life as essentially a farm boy, living in a farm outside a small market town in Lincolnshire and going to school in that small town, then going to Cambridge and staying at Cambridge from the time he entered as a student to the time he left for the Mint, 1661 to 1695. That point he's in his early 50s. And he spent his entire life as either a kid on a farm or, a studious, almost, sort of stereotype of the impractical professor, the absent-minded, literally the absent-minded professor. He'd forget to eat his dinner and so forth. And he shows up in London and almost immediately is told, you have to pursue this rampant explosion of crime that no one else has been able to tame, right? You got to go do this. And Chaloner, I think, among others, felt that the warden, this new warden, this country bumpkin, this head in the clouds professor, didn't stand a chance against the wiles of the big city. And yet, within a very few months, Newton had a whole detective shop up and running. He had agents running. He had agents, running into London. He had himself sworn in as a justice. I'm blanking on the term, but an officer of the court. In not just London, but the counties immediately around London. So he had jurisdiction wherever he needed to go. I mean, he worked out the essential structure of counterfeiting as a crime, which is in the end, you have to get somebody on the street passing a dud coin. And if you catch that person, you can, by a mixture of promises and threats, roll up the chain till you get, hopefully, to people like Chaloner with the kingpins. Newton figured that all out within months. It was amazing.
How do you think he made that happen? I mean, we get, as you said, we get stories of him as an investigator that are really out of character for the solitary scientist who did nothing but pull the occasional weed from his garden as his only distraction, to someone, hauling prisoners out into the hallway and not being afraid to go directly to the prisons and even into sort of taverns and places to try and do this rolling up. How do you think he made that happen?
Again, it's one of those situations where we have a vision of who Newton ought to have been, and Newton had his own ideas. Sort of take it to a different, a different venue. In one of his other jobs in the Mint was running this recoinage, where Newton took in all of its silver coinage, all these debased and battered coins, and took all the old coins out of circulation and melted them down and made new coins up to the legal standard that were hard to count for various reasons, hard to counterfeit and so forth and so on. It's called the Great Recoinage, and it was an attempt that Newton predicted would fail and did fail, but it was an attempt to save the currency from the problem that obtained when Newton showed up. And Newton took charge of this from the people who were actually botching it when he came in. He didn't really have the authority, but he just used his force of personality to do so. And so you have this apparently empty-headed professor running a huge industrial operation, several hundred men, 50 horses, hundreds and hundreds of pounds of silver every day or every week, ultimately recoining, you know, 5 to 7 million pounds. Again, I'm sort of trying to pull the numbers out of memory, but millions upon millions of English pounds, not pounds weight, of currency, and doing so with meticulous record keeping at a rate of industrial production that nobody had ever dreamed possible. It was certainly greater than any achieved in any other mint anywhere working in Europe. And you wonder how he did that. And then you remember, if you look at his alchemy again, you see he was an immensely practical man. He understood the melting of metal. He had built his own furnaces, inventing, you know, variations on forms of furnaces. He'd worked over fire and moving metal around and all that sort of stuff. He'd had an intensely practical life as an experimental scientist or natural mm-hmm. philosopher going into it. And even though that wasn't part of his resume, he didn't talk openly about being an alchemist. It was of immense value to him in just the hard, practical job of essentially being a metal stamping factory manager. That's, you know, that's really what coining, you know, coining currency is all about.
Yeah.
And similarly, I think, you know, if you look at Newton closely, you find he was somewhat more engaged in university politics than you thought he was. He was one of Cambridge's delegation to the court hearing that King James II tried to use to punish Cambridge when it refused to admit his Catholic supporters. And he was an active person there. He was a member of Parliament, member of the Convention Parliament. He was a more worldly man than, you know, I'm not saying he was, you know, Warren Buffett or what have you. I mean, but he was a much more worldly man, I think, than he sometimes, and particularly as he matured. I think as a young man, he very much shied from conflict and engagement with other people. There's certainly that dispute in the 1670s with Hooke and the Royal Society. But by the 1690s, I think he was much more prepared than the legend has it for a more rough and tumble engagement with daily life.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, he's a human being and matures as he ages and changes through experience as well.
Yep.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. Today I'm talking to Tom Levinson, author of Newton and the Counterfeiter, The Unknown Detective Career of the World's Greatest Scientist. So we were talking a little bit about sources, and we have one more question sent to us by Greg by email.
What is the most salacious thing you uncovered about life in the 17th century while researching this book?
London was a riotous place. I mean, I had done a book about Einstein before, and it was focused on Einstein in Berlin, which is these years 1914 to 1932, which includes, of course, the famous Weimar years when Berlin was the naughtiest city in the world and so forth. And, you know, I started reading about the sex life of London after the restoration of the Stuarts in the 1660s. And, you know, there was an enormous culture and working life of prostitution. You had a lot of people flowing into the city from the countryside. London was a deadly city. More people died than were born there at that time and for many decades to come. But the population was leaping up all the time. The population was growing, which meant that basically there was, you know, fresh meat coming in from the countryside. And a lot of these people couldn't find work, you know, not easy. You show up in the tenements and all of a sudden you look around, and for young women, in many cases, the only thing they had to sell were their bodies. And the whorehouses and sort of sexual life of Britain in the 1660s and onwards became quite notorious. So I'm not sure what's the most salacious thing I heard, but I did love the story of a well-known roué coming into one of the best-known sort of high-end whorehouses and saying, forgive the language here, but it's a quote, "Just some plain f***ing for me tonight." Which implies that there was other than plain items on the menu most nights. You know, it was a much more openly libidinous city than it would become. I mean, again, we look at London through the filter of Victorian myth. Yeah. And so we think of it as an uptight city. And I don't think it was ever as uptight as that Victorian myth had it. But certainly in those late 17th century years, it wasn't. You can even see that in the way that there were these pushbacks and campaigns to try and clean the place up. You don't clean up a place that hasn't got some rowdy stuff going on.
That's right. If there's no need to clean it.
Exactly.
Oh, very good. Well, talking about salacious, I guess, you did say something on the break about money and death. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I mean, at the heart of the story, I mean, I hope the book informs and excites people about the themes of, I mean, my big idea there is the scientific revolution wasn't just a sequence of ideas. It was a transformative event that played out in people's lives and still does. And you can see it working through the lives of people in England at the time and after in all kinds of things, from as mundane a thing as a guy selling fake watches, because high tech in that day created a market for those things. And these much bigger ideas that you can, just as you can abstract the motion of physical objects into these mathematical formulas, you can abstract the motion of money into literally the calculations you do on debt and so forth and so on. But all of those themes, trying to understand how we get from, you know, the world of the pre-modern, the medieval, the late medieval era, into a world that we begin to recognize as our own and a shaper of our own, it's actually happening through the lives and stories of individuals. And in this case, this book runs on the energy of the story of Chaloner trying to get rich, and if Newton's in his way, get rich while ruining Newton, and Newton's determination to bring Chaloner down. And, you know, at first Newton doesn't realize that Chaloner is such a threat. When he does, he creates this incredible web of informants around him, so much so that that when he had Chaloner in jail, he had informants three deep inside the cell, so that when Chaloner, you know, clammed up sensibly at the obvious informants, he still spoke to the one he didn't know about, he didn't recognize. And the result, of course, was the terrible fate that counterfeiters faced if they were caught and convicted. Chaloner was hung under the same penalty for high treason that, you know, Mel Gibson made famous in his medieval torture how-to film at the end of Braveheart. You know, Chaloner didn't suffer the full extent of that Mel Gibson in his torture porn managed to convey. But still, it was a terrible, horrible way to die, and that was, he did so at the end of Newton's two-year-long quest to put him in that predicament.
His fear was actually really that first letter that you said you found, that first correspondent, I think, seemed to show that his fear really was legitimate. At that point, he didn't want that fate. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And also at that point, his fate was sealed. Not to you know, bedevil your listeners, our listeners, but, you know, when you were executed in late 17th century England, you knew it. And the punishment for high treason was really very severe. You were drawn to the place of execution on a rough sledge, so whatever filth there was in the streets. And remember, there were only open sewers in Britain at the time. These streets were this sort of awash in animal and human excrement, and the whole, you know, it wasn't pleasant, right?
Yes.
You know, celebrated criminals would often be given gin along the way by admirers, not counterfeiters. They were people who had been convicted of treason for, you know, playing with the king's face on the coin. You get to the gallows, they don't have trapdoor gallows. This isn't that image of, you know, string them up in the Old West where, you know, you drop and your neck snaps and you're dead. This is, you're at the top of a ladder, the ladder gets taken away and you dangle. Mm. And if you were wealthy enough, still, if you had enough resources, you could pay the hangman to pull on your legs to speed death. Or if you had friends, they might rush the gallows and do the same. But Chaloner was broke and friendless. So he would just do what was called the hangman's dance, twitch and struggle till he died. Not fun.
No,
not good at all.
It's awful.
as always, worse for women. Women who were convicted of treason, of coining, were sentenced to be burned to death because it was considered immodest for somebody to see them twitching in this sort of in the hangman's dance, because it was a it was seen as a sort of parody of erotic whatever. So they were burned, and usually kindness had it they would be strangled to death on the pyre before the fire was lit, but it didn't quite always happen. So it is always worse for women.
Oh, a terrible fate for both, really.
Absolutely.
So I guess kind of on that note, I also hear that you're working on a new book that's a bit of an informal sequel to Newton. More fraud, more corruption, more money.
Absolutely. And Newton's actually still involved because in the early part of the 18th century, you have all these new ideas about money. You have joint stock companies, you know, flourishing. You have new banks. You have checks. You have bonds. You have enormous amounts of government debt. You have all kinds of things. And what that kind of ferment, what that kind of financial engineering means is you have essentially an unlimited scope for fraud, deceit, criminal behavior, and plain stupidity. And I'm looking at a particular incident that happened in the early 18th century where all of these came to bear. I'm doing so because, really, first of all, Newton loses his shirt, and it's South Sea Bubble is what it's called. But secondly, what happens that's really interesting out of it is there's you see in microcosm essentially what happened to us in 2008. And because the South Sea Bubble turned out in exactly the way it did, there are, I think, some very contemporary lessons to be learned by looking at this this moment in history with kind of new eyes. It's been written about a lot, but it tends to have been written about in a very Victorian manner, and I hope to do something a bit different. But I'm still in early stages on that, so I probably shouldn't talk too much about it.
All right. But I did find that interesting, even in this book, how much of that early history of bonds and sort of different kinds of markets for money really is so meaningful right now as a, you know, something that we can learn from where these came from.
The lesson I most drew from this was that, you know, financial engineering is actually, under certain circumstances, a really useful thing. You know, as I said, you know, the creation of modern finance in its first form transformed England from a relatively impoverished country on the fringes of Europe to a world-spanning power, for good and ill, I guess. But what you see in time after time is that they have collapses and failures because human nature works in predictable ways. And every time you try out something new, there are moments of fragility and there are points of weakness in the idea that people can either fall into if, you know, well-meaning but you know, uninformed or stupid, or can, you know, set out to exploit because they are malign. And, you know, what this says is you need to, you know, you need to create circumstances in which people can do things with finance, but you also need to be very clever but very determined about regulating the financial world. And this is a view that drives people on both sides, on many sides of arguments about capitalism crazy, because I strongly believe in a rigorous government regulation model. But I also think, you know, no, it's not true that you know, mortgage-backed securities or whatever on their own are the source of all evil in society.
Right. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Yep, I'm afraid it is.
There is so much to this story, Tom. I feel like we could keep talking for another hour. But unfortunately, we are out of time. Thanks so much for being here tonight and giving us really a new way to look at a legendary scientist and the times that he lived in.
Thank you so much. It was a great conversation.
You'll find links to Tom Levinson and his book, Newton and the Counterfeiter, on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click on the links to Facebook, Twitter, and to Google+, so you can keep up with new shows, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to our program or listen to past episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.